I just want to underscore the kind words of our listener member. We suspended our member drive on AirTalk and throughout our KPCC schedule so that we can bring you the in-depth coverage of COVID-19. But we still have to raise $1 million in total by Friday to assure that we can balance the budget here at KPCC. And if you're someone who's going through tough financial times because of COVID-19, we completely understand. And all I can say is all of us are with you, and our thoughts and concerns are with you during this time. But if you can contribute right now, when we have a $50,000 challenge from our board member, Kathy Ward and George Ward, please do so right now. We have had a tremendous outpouring of support just in the past few minutes since I last brought this up. Nearly 50 AirTalk listeners have given. This is extraordinary, particularly since we're taking such little time to do this. Please, please, with the $50,000 challenge, if you can make your contribution, join with these other tremendously generous and kind listeners in supporting what we do. We're at 866-888-5722. That's 866-888-5722. Or you can click and join at kpecc.org. With us to talk about COVID-19 anxiety versus alarmism is Professor of Public Health and Director of the Public Health Program at Hunter College in New York City, Philip Alcabas. He's joined us in the past to talk about whether our fears are justified. His book of a few years ago is titled Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to the Avian Flu. Philip Alcabas, good to have you with us again on AirTalk. First of all, is there any kind of a comparison we can make here historically to what we're going through with COVID-19?
Well, there's probably no comparison to anything in our lifetimes. That there have surely been outbreaks that have been even deadlier than this, but a long time ago. So in that sense, it's unprecedented.
So people, of course, are highly anxious about this. One of the issues seems to me that we still don't really have a handle on how many people have the virus because of the delay in getting the testing infrastructure up and fully operational. Do you anticipate once everyone who is an obvious candidate to get tested can get tested and can get timely test results, that will be the biggest sort of salve for people's anxieties?
I don't. I wish I could say yes, but I cannot say yes. It's in the nature of epidemic anxieties, as I'll use the word you did, to be driven by a conversation that's fueled by information coming from everywhere, not just data on tests and test results. We like to think of ourselves as rational. I know I do. But that's not how epidemic anxieties work. And in this day and age, when information is everywhere, we all of us, or most of us, live in a sea of information that's coming from mainstream media and social media and our friends. It would be unusual if people could simply, were simply to take reassurance from test results. I think that where we are in the public conversation about COVID-19 is going to have a life of its own and will take longer to dissipate than the test results show, the test results on the virus itself reveal.
So you're someone who's written about alarmism, and it sounds like what you're saying is people do have good reason to be deeply concerned with what we're experiencing.
People have good reason to be concerned and to take appropriate measures. The a problem that Americans are facing now is that the advice about what those measures are and realistic information for those at least who are willing to pay attention to that has been so spotty, irregular, contradictory, that people have to be forgiven for not knowing what they should be doing themselves.
We're talking with public health authority Philip Alcabas of Hunter College in New York City. He directs the public health program that's part of the City University of New York system. He's author of the book from about a decade ago, Dread, How Fear and Fantasy Have Fueled Epidemics from the Black Death to the avian flu. There's been a lot of you know, looking back to the early part of the 20th century and the Spanish flu. My great-grandmother actually got sick with that, and her health never really fully recovered afterwards. I remember her being rather sickly, you know, when I was a kid. And what are some of the things that we learned from that epidemic?
Ooh, that's a very interesting question. Did we learn anything from that epidemic? It until fairly recently, or let me say this, for decades after the 1918 to 1919 flu, so-called Spanish flu, there was very little discussion of it. Americans started to think about that epidemic only in the 1970s or 80s, long after it was over. It was the worst acute, that is, took place in the space of about 15 months, outbreak in American history. Killed, nobody knows how many Americans exactly, but the estimates are about 600 to 700,000 Americans in the course of a year or so.
A much smaller country.
In a much smaller country, in a country whose population was then only 100 and something million, I forget exactly. That was a very, very big deal. And the first response was to not talk about it for a generation or so. I'm sure your great-grandmother had something to say, but it wasn't part of the public conversation. And I don't
It was actually her son. She didn't talk about it.
Oh, okay. So that's really interesting, right? Like, there was something either shameful or forgettable that people wanted to bury, to put behind them. And that the importance of that outbreak was resuscitated in really the 1980s.
All right. Hey, I thank you so much, Professor Philip Alcabas, joining us, Hunter College, New York City. He directs the public health program at Hunter. We have much more to come on COVID-19 in the second hour of Air Talk here on 89.3 KPCC. I'll tell you about it in a moment.